the drama of life on our planet plays itself out on a longer time scale than human life, yet human life has vastly accelerated it. How much faster? We're going to find out. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Climate warming hastens extinction, but what do you think the priorities ought to be in reacting? A call is toll-free from anywhere in Alaska. Our email is talk@alaskapublic.org. Active management of our ecosystem, the subject today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
It's an exciting time for science. The measurements for the Anthropocene era are only now being devised. What is the layer that gets laid down in the geologic record because of humanity? Is it nuclear fallout? Well, that would die away after a few tens of thousands of years. Maybe it's plastic. It could be. Humanity has been doing some amazing things with carbon. The current consensus says it is the combined products of industrialization. But really, it started before that, when the large carnivores were basically eaten into extinction by early humans. That changed the ecosystems. And now, the planet's albedo loss, the pushing past the Milankovitch cycle of glaciation, is just one of the ways the planet's biogeochemical cycles have been altered by this amazing tool-using killer ape that is humanity. There's also the way we facilitate the movement of the planet's life. So we have species in danger because of humans, and we have species that are invasive because of humans. Christy Thomas is a professor of conservation biology at York University and joins us from there by digital link. Chris, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hello, Stephen. Great to be with you.
Yeah, well, thank you for hanging around the office after hours. I guess it's getting on towards 8 o'clock there.
It's getting to dusk.
Yeah. And you're at the University of York. Where is that? Is that up north a ways, isn't it?
That's in York. It's the University of York, which is not to be confused with York University in Canada. So it's in northern England, but we're bathed in the Gulf Stream, so we don't get cold winters like you, but we also get rather wet and cool summers, alas.
Well, Chris is a butterfly man. Let me tell them a little about you, Chris. Chris was the lead author of a widely cited 2004 study that estimated the risk of extinction of species due to climate change. He has continued that research, and extinction is the subject of his book, published last year, Inheritors of the Earth, How Nature is Thriving in an Age of Extinction. It has some in the conservation community concerned that it's putting out the wrong message. And I think, Chris, you would be among those who would have that concern, right?
Yes. Funnily enough, it's the reason I nearly didn't write the book, worried that people would say, okay, some species are doing well, therefore we don't need to worry about conservation. It's not really a competition. Lots of species can do badly on the planet because of us as humans, as you say, predatory apes. But simultaneously, if you just think of the transformation of the world that we're managing to achieve, there's lots of other animals and plants loads of insects which are able to move into the new types of environment that are created by humans. And they're doing really well. And of course, as the climate warms, it turns out across the planet's surface as a whole, there are actually more species that like it hot than cold. So the species that have got very restricted geographic ranges, live on the tops of mountains, or of course the polar bear that can't go further north. So there's lots of species that are endangered by climate change, but there are also loads of others that are moving into new areas and may actually do quite well as a consequence. So we're living in this kind of amazingly biologically dynamic planet, and we have to get used to the idea that nature changes. Nature's a dynamic thing. And when we think about conservation, we need to think about the direction of change rather than trying to keep things just the way they are.
How long did it take you to write this book, Inheritors of the Earth?
Well, that's a hard thing to test. So the whole period start to finish was 3 years, but the main writing period was a year and a bit. But when I sort of work out how many hours it might have taken, I reckon I was writing it at below the minimum permissible hourly wage rate that's legal within Britain.
Well, that goes without saying for any author, but... But you, you know, in here, clearly it's informed by your experience as a field researcher.
Yeah.
I mean, this goes back to research you did many years ago with butterflies, and you got a paper in there with Camille Parmesan, I noticed. And
yeah, well, what I sort of gradually, I must be rather a slow learner or something, but what I gradually realized that pretty much every kind of animal and plant that I'd studied during my career, and I'm starting to get on a bit now, I'm in my late 50s, had made some kind of adjustment to the human world. And so they were actually being more successful than you might have expected because of that adjustment. So whether it's a butterfly that's feeding in forest clearings that have been made by people, or it's... bees that have arrived, something called a tree bumblebee that's arrived in my garden in Britain in the last few years because the climate has warmed. Wherever you look, you see species that are doing really quite well because rather than in spite of humans. And my argument is that we shouldn't ignore these. These are really interesting. They're part of what's happening to our planet, just as it's interesting and important to think about the losses.
Well, generally speaking, there's an attempt to fight off invasive species because of fear that they take over, that they lead to a simplified ecosystem, that they are noxious, that they're often inedible. But you're basically have counterarguments to all of that.
I have a number of counterarguments. I mean, I think the first is that when people look at a species, if it's foreign, their default position is it's harmful, potentially dangerous, until proven, it's kind of guilty till proven innocent. Whereas if it's a native species, however that is defined, then things are innocent until proven guilty and nuisance. Whereas I would argue that species are just species. Some of them are troublesome for people, and that's and our livestock and all the rest of it. But that's not normally because of their origins. And if you think about any particular part of the planet, the climate has changed hugely over the last 15 to 20,000 years. Okay, I have to admit that it takes a little bit of effort to persuade my in-laws that 15,000 years is particularly relevant. But this is a really short snapshot in terms of the history of life on Earth. And over that time scale, species have moved huge distances, and not only have they moved huge distances, but the biological communities that they're living in are now completely different. So on that time scale, pretty much everything is a newcomer. Now, I regret to say I haven't been to Alaska yet, but where I live, 15,000 years ago, I was on the edge of an enormous glacier, and all of the species that live round where I live now in northern England have arrived in the last about 10,000 years. They're all newcomers. They're all immigrants. And yet we sort of are making this sort of, I would argue, rather prejudicial distinction between those that arrived 10,000 years ago. Yeah, that's okay. They're native. 8,000 years ago. Yeah, that's okay. 5,000. Well, we might call them non-native, but we'll definitely think they're fully naturalized, so they're okay. If they were brought by the Romans 2,000 years ago, not quite so sure. 1,000 years ago, Normans, not quite so sure. 500 years, dodgy. And then if they're in the 300 years, they're definitely bad until proven good.
Oh, so Chris, this is
a really weird thing that's going on, and it's because people aren't thinking about the time scales over which nature changes and the geographic scales over which it changes. And because the climate is now changing so fast, that's happening again, and we've just got to get our heads around it.
Chris, you're killing me here. You're just killing me. All this business.
Of course, it's entirely British prejudice. I'm sure that everyone in North America takes an entirely balanced view of it.
Unquestionably. Well, I want to take you over to the issue of rapid evolution, but I think I'm going to save that to introduce our next guest, and we'll step up the pace on the show. It's Talk of Alaska. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, it's a local number, 550-8422. You taking all this down? And email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And so now I want to turn to Mark Nelson. Mark, how you doing?
Doing great. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you here. I should, I think, say to begin here that Mark and I have known each other for some years. And so I have some idea of how he thinks about these things. But Dr. Mark Nelson was one of the eight people who locked themselves within a closed ecosystem and lived there for 2 years. That was 1991 to 93. His second book about that, well, actually, I guess there's more books than that, Pushing Our Limits, Insights from Biosphere 2, describing that experience from the point of view of the participants, has just been published. And he joins us by telephone from Santa Fe, New Mexico, or outside of Santa Fe. Mark, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah. We did this 4 years ago about the subject of something I don't think I can say, caca.
Yeah.
How to recycle human waste products.
Yeah.
And now we're going to a little bit more cosmic theme, I think, today.
Yeah, well, Mark, you know, I think that one thing that came out with that discussion is we're looking for alternatives for dealing with human sewage in Alaska, but that you weren't much of an expert on it because it's cold up here, and all your work is in warmer latitudes. But this idea,
well, like Chris was saying, you know, I mean, I can handle it when it's not a solid ice crystal.
Uh-huh.
those are special problems.
Yeah. Well, I'm really.
I think we should send. Can't we send it all to Alaska and just freeze it?
I don't know. It might be open for business on that one, really.
That was the early solution of NASA, actually, and why John Glenn had that vision of golden showers around my spacecraft. What could it be?
Oh, dear me.
They thought he was going crazy until they realized that was your frozen urine, old bean.
Mark, seriously, you actually got to meet a lot of these astronauts, didn't you?
I did.
Yeah.
And actually, there's a link to Pushing Our Limits. And I think it's taken me 20 years. Being inside Biosphere 2 was such an amazing, all-encompassing roller coaster of, you know, profound despair and, you know, frustration at the human condition and the condition of the eight humans inside to, you know, the most amazing feeling of connectedness with a living system. So I think it took me 20 years to write this book. And you know, I think it's important because what we learned in there was kind of like what I got from the astronauts, you know, and they talk about it, and there's been some books about the overview effect, that astronauts have this unique perspective. They can look down and see our spinning biosphere, and they begin to appreciate everything that they know and love and that any human being has known and loved is contained on that one world. Well, then when I was reflecting, I said, well, you know, us biospherians, and unfortunately, because after a second crew, the facility's been repurposed. We have an interview. We had an interview of living intensely with a totally micro or mini biospheric system. And the insights that we had, also watching and hearing about, you know, the what humans are doing with our love of technology and our obliviousness to the fact that the global biosphere one, is our life support, was staggering and appalling.
Yeah, and I think that you really touched on something that I think is very important. And I think you say all eight of the people who underwent this experience came out. You know, I used to say years ago when I was in top 40 radio, boy, all these space cadets come back and they get religion. But it's true. It's true. And the same thing happened with you guys. You came out with a certain reverence for the living systems of the Earth that came out of that experience, I think. All of you.
Yeah, no, totally. And you know, because I had worked in ecology for, you know, 25 years before going into Biosphere 2. So to say there was, you know, kind of a seismic or more really a visceral bodily realization, it's like all that I kind of knew theoretically about the relationship of humans and our technology and all our activities that were inside a biosphere and dependent on it, that transferred really quickly down into our body, where we had this cellular knowledge and reverence for. We could keep the machinery going, do the research, and certainly in a man-made biosphere, that's necessary. But if the plants and the microbes and the untold species inside that system cease to do their job, function properly, you know, we were screwed. There wouldn't be any life support.
And so
that was a sobering realization for all the engineers who created Biosphere 2. They normally can guarantee our bridges don't fall down, our highways you can drive safely on. But, you know, in Biosphere 2, technology was a supporting actor. Life ruled.
Yeah, part of the drama in the book is that your carbon dioxide builds up really fast. And
right.
Basically, you all have to jump on board on that, all hands on deck, and do all kinds of things you hadn't anticipated to get that carbon sequestered, and you did.
Yeah, you know, at the time, 91 to 93, I mean, you know, scientists, were talking about global climate change, but it wasn't an everyday thing, but it became one of our chief preoccupations because, you know, even people on our staff who were looking at the data before we went in said, you're not going to last the first winter. CO2 is going to rise. So
Lynn Margulis say something about all the vermin are going to get you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, to Chris's point about weeds, you know, I think a lot of ecologists underappreciated the sophistication of, you know, really top-quality engineering and you know, so people doubted that we could have a rainforest and a fog desert and a coral reef and a mangrove system and a functioning farm, you know, within 3 acres, a little over 1 hectare of land. You know, so Lynn Margulis, you know, who loved the project, you know, this is biosphere starting to replicate. She thought that the inevitable thing would be we'd have urban weeds, the most prolific invasive species would just dominate, and we wouldn't have five different biomes.
And it didn't come out that way. You pretty much held on to them. You kept your ocean. They had to be modified, though. You had to modify them.
Well, I mean, they were modified to begin with. I mean, the point about the Anthropocene, Biosphere 2 was beyond, you know, restoration ecology, and I love the points Chris makes about these moral distinctions, the sort of PE, you know, the proper ecology that invasives are bad and natives are good. You know, this was creation ecology. How do you make a rainforest from scratch and you're in the Sonoran Desert? You're 3,900 feet. Can you really transplant an Everglades mangrove and have it function? Can you Can you make a tropical coral reef 3,900 feet above sea level?
Okay, you know, so, okay, so enough bragging. we got things to talk about here.
We talked about comparative biospherics, and I think, you know, what Chris's work is sort of showing is that, you know, this illusion that we have a biosphere and it's not continually changing and hasn't for, you know, millions, if not hundreds of millions and billions of years, is kind of a fantasy.
Yeah. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I was just going to say that the Biosphere 2 is such a nice demonstration of humans as part of the system, and as part of the system, every element of the system was then affected by what the people did. And that is effectively what's happening on Biosphere 1 on our planet. And I think that the transition to thinking of ourselves as now entering the Anthropocene epoch, if that's what is then agreed, is that it really focuses our mind that we are just genuinely part of the system, and that the whole system's being changed by us, and there isn't any longer a natural out there without humans and a bit that we've stuffed up. It's that we've really got a dynamic system with us playing a key role in it now.
Okay, I'm going to have a little bit more byplay with you, Mark. First off, I got to talk to one of the crew that cleaned up after you guys, and she said there were a lot of cockroaches there, and they found the skeleton of one of the primates. That's what she told me. And Tony Burgess, who stayed with the project and who you know, I think you even studied with him. Tony now lives in Alaska, and I got to have a conversation with him. And I asked him, Tony, he told me he thought, you know, we really could have just put a dome right on top of the desert and had the same thing happen, which I think is an exaggeration. But I asked him, I said, Tony, do you think you guys were playing God? And he said, absolutely. Playing God.
We might have been playing God, but the thing is that, you know, it's like the I wrote a poem where I use the word Franken-system. You know, people accused us of being really audacious. So, you know, you think you can choose species. Well, we had to choose the species because, you know, you don't open your door in Arizona and have rainforest species volunteer send their propagules. But you begin to learn the limits of what you can control. So there's, you know, which again is quite analogous with the modern world, is that we may think that we are in charge of the biosphere. That is a crazy illusion. We are certainly impacting it and unfortunately doing it mostly unconsciously and unintentionally. Unintended consequences maybe should be the theme song of the 20th and 21st centuries.
Oh, boy, oh, boy. We're ready for the calls, I think. Let's go to Don, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Don. Thanks for your patience. We had to get through a lot of exposition here.
You sure have. You got a lot more to go. I was born and raised in northern Ohio near Lake Erie, and I've been down to Arizona as well as up here in Alaska now for 50 years. And one of the first things I did when I got up here was to make a visit to Portage Glacier. And people got any doubts about global warming, I suggest they go down there and take a look at the map and stuff. I presume it's still there. It showed where the glacier was at around 1948 and before that, as well as where it was currently today. And for those who have been down there today and not years ago, Portage Glacier was right up near the very mouth of where the lodge still sits. So it's receded about at least a mile from what I understand. So the glaciers and stuff are warming. The ocean floors are getting put under more pressure because there's more water coming off of the glaciers and whatnot. The land itself is getting stressed with less pressure because there is less water and glacier activity up on top of the land. But the main thing I wanted to say as far as you guys and the subject of God is concerned, we had a pastor at one time that said, put it very bluntly, if you think God is a he, the next time you have a chat with Mother Nature, ask her. So, but as far as the species are concerned, things tend to pretty much evolve, sometimes pretty slowly, but I'll stick with the laws of Mother Nature, both in and outside of the universe as we know it, and trust that it knows pretty much what it's doing, be it he, she, or somewhere in between. So I'll let you guys go. A good program this morning. I'm glad you're on. I hope you get a lot more like it for your drive and getting a lot more money to help support them. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Don. Yeah, I guess I should intervene that the public broadcasting is undergoing fundraising right now. Just a little plug. So let's go now to Kay. Joins the program from Juneau. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Kay.
Kay. This is Kay McCarthy calling in from Juneau.
How do you do?
And, it's a beautiful day here today. Very lovely. Very springy. But I'm calling in because I am worried about the biotech people. They really scare me a lot more than the oil companies do. And one of the things that really concerns me about the general tenor, at least I think I'm getting this right, is that it sort of doesn't matter if these extinctions are occurring. You know, we're involved in what Elizabeth Colbert calls the sixth extinction, and it's mainly caused by human beings. And one of the things that concerns me the deepest is just the hubris, the arrogance and disregard that human beings seem to have for other species and the rights of other species. And I don't think, I mean, I know the man from York believes that species are just species, but in my view, because of my preferences and my likes and dislikes, I prefer salmon over squid. Now, squid may take over because salmon is crashing and we will have a lot more squid, but I would prefer to eat salmon rather than squid. So this has been happening for a long time. This happened in Monterey Bay with overfishing and the crash of the sardine fishery and the anchoveta that moved in there. I mean, it's been happening in the world all over. But human beings don't seem to have much of a capacity to reflect on the implications of this. And whereas we may be wrong in our approach to wanting to protect and preserve certain species, I am concerned that the idea that we can just let things be as they, and I don't think that's what you're saying, but that we can create these environments or that we can rest easy because other species are moving in. Some species are preferable to other species, in my opinion. And I don't think we can just go on blithely burning oil and or all the oil that we have and say, well, it doesn't really matter because the technological fixes are out there and we'll be fine.
Kay, so, you've cut to the absolute heart of the conversation here today, and I really appreciate this. I know that both of our panelists are absolutely dying to dig into the things that you said. Do you want to stay with us while we let them tangle with it?
Sure. Well, I appreciate the program, as you know, and
yes.
I have called in before, and I am very much involved in conservation activities, and I consider myself a conservationist.
Conserving. I think you're going to want to read both of these books, particularly Chris's. And Chris, I'll give you the floor right now because this is exactly the kind of misinterpretation that you were afraid of.
Yeah, well, not really. That's a brilliant question because it wasn't a question. It just goes to the heart of so many different things. So let me try and set one thing straight, that I am actually very concerned about the extinction of species, the life on Earth that we've got. And that's not to try and keep things as they are now necessarily, but because they represent the world's spare parts. And whatever humans do to the planet in the future, however we change the climate, whichever new chemical or whatever other insult we throw at the planet, all the new biological systems that come into existence in that new world are going to be populated by the descendants of today's species, however unlike today's biological communities they look like. And so I do think that the keeping species, where possible, is really a good idea. And the fact that I recognize, as I think we all do now, that humans are central to the biological system of the planet means that we're completely free to intervene to make more salmon and fewer squid if we want to, if that's our choice. That's perfectly fine. In terms of the world's resources, the real challenge is that human population is still going up, and it'll be, 7.4 or something, I can't remember what the latest number of billion people, heading for 10 billion. The food consumption, fortunately, I should say, very fortunately, of people in Eastern Asia and increasingly in Africa is starting to increase. We would want everyone in the world to be well fed. So that's great, but that means that getting on for double the food production is required. So that's going to require quite a lot of further intervention. The world isn't just going to stop. And one of the things we can potentially do is to look to new approaches, whether it be through fish farming or other approaches, in which we start to manage the oceans in a responsible, proper way. Up till now, we've just pretended we're still hunter-gatherer foragers, humans, putting great big nets in and say, oh, look what I can get. And it's just no way to manage the oceans to produce food that we're going to use.
We're going to have to take a break here, and I'm kind of sorry you broached that subject because, boy, if you ever want to get an argument going in Alaska, just bring up fish farms. But we need to take a break, Chris, and we'll come right back. We're talking about, the Anthropocene and rapid biological change as Talk Alaska continues.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
So Chris D. Thomas, professor of conservation biology at University of York, wrote this in his book, Inheritors of the Earth. We cannot simply continue to wish that we live in an unchanged world. We have to develop an understanding of biology and an approach to conservation that works with change rather than against it. And taking exception was Kay from Juneau. Oh, we lost her, did we? Oh, well. Sorry. Well, I guess you get to hold forth a bit more on this, Chris, because I know you would like to counter some of the things that that she was saying, because you're certainly not saying, oh, we just go ahead and put more CO2 into the atmosphere and so forth.
No, and if we're prioritizing things for our effort, it is often that we should tackle the fundamental cause of the problem, such as greenhouse gas emissions, rather than spend all of our time trying to mop up the problem after we've caused it. The biological systems changing are often the symptom of something else
rather than the cause of the problem. And we look at these changing biological systems and we say, oh, it's all going wrong. But this is, if you like, nature, the biological system's way of adjusting to the new conditions rather than the cause. And very often we kind of, particularly when foreign plants are establishing and becoming part of new biological communities, we blame the messenger almost rather than the fundamental cause.
Tanya weighed in and saying, well, would you go so far as to say that there's a real advantage to having more biodiversity in terms of a buffer effect?
Well, it's, yes, I think I would. And the reason I would, but I mean, it's a hunch a little bit more than proof. And that is because some of the species that are very common and widespread today, and indeed important for humanity, used to be rare in the quite recent past. So the trees that clothe parts of Alaska and the northern parts of North America, most of those have only established in the last 10,000 years ago, and they would have been much more restricted at the last ice ages. The forest that covers Europe today, the oak trees and so on, were rare, very rare trees a matter of 15,000 years ago, and now they make up the ecosystems. One of my favorite examples is the Monterey pine, which is listed as an endangered species, and it just occurs along coastal California and a couple of small Mexican islands off Baja. And this is a really rare plant. It's threatened by future climate change because it does worse when the climate gets warmer. That's been seen in studies that have examined its how common it's been over the last million years. And it's affected by disease. There's lots of urbanization. There's loads of things going on why the Monterey pine is threatened. But some foresters who either were inspired or just got lucky took some of this particular tree and started planting it in New Zealand. And it did very well because it likes this just-so climate. It's not too hot, not too cold, not too wet, not too dry that you get just along this coastal fringe in California. Take it to New Zealand. It says, yes, thank you very much. I like this climate. It's much nicer than California. And it grew incredibly fast. And now it's their main forestry tree. In fact, it's the single most important economic tree for forestry in New Zealand, Australia, Chile. It's also widely planted in Argentina and South Africa. And in South Africa, it's completely escaped and it's gone wild. So this really rare species is now no longer endangered, it's widespread, and it's commercially important to humans. Now, that's happened in the past and up to the present. Now, I am lousy at predict. We're all lousy at predicting the future. Imagine what your great-great-grandparents would have predicted if they lived in the Victorian era, what they would have predicted the present would be and all the technologies and things we have. They just couldn't have guessed. And I imagine that if we try and forecast what the world's going to be like in 150 years' time, we're going to be equally useless at it. And so the species that are out there are, if you like, the reservoir of all of those biological entities that might be able to make a go of it in that future biological world, whatever it turns out to be exactly like. And I don't think we can predict. And that's why I think it's good to keep as much as possible as a kind of insurance policy.
Yeah, you know, I sometimes think about that as I understand it in the geography of biological systems, that the place where a species originated, isn't that to also tend to be the repository of a lot of the variation of genes? In other words, potatoes in Peru. You know, there's this great story about the potatoes in Peru that people got down to monoculture potatoes, and then they got some of their old friend potatoes from out of Svalbard, and now they're going great guns at all different elevations and conditions that basically have been wiped out. In other words, there might be certain places on a planet where the genes are, there's more of a selection of genes if you look at all the wild plants, especially like rainforest.
Yeah, and that's a really good point because we know that where species survived the last ice ages, for example, We know that the populations that still survive in those locations often have, but not always, but often have greater genetic variation than the new ones that are being colonized. But it's not necessarily like that in the long run. So camels evolved in North America, but now they only survive in Asia, the Arabian Peninsula, and as introduced to Australia, plus their descendants in South America as vicuña and guanacos and their domesticated alpacas and llamas. And so in that case, all of the genetic diversity that exists on this planet today that is descended from llamas lives in continents where they didn't evolve. So sometimes what you say is true, and it is often true, but it's not inevitably true. And as the world changes, fewer and fewer species are going to live in the places where they evolved. In fact, we often assume that localized species that only occur in one mountain range, for example, must have evolved there. But we now know from a lot of biological research this isn't necessarily true. So there's a species of dung beetle that only lives in Tibet. And there's another one that only lives in the Pyrenees Mountains in Europe. So very rare beetles, seem crazy. But about 12,000, 13,000 years ago, they were amongst the commonest dung beetles in lowland Britain. So stuff moves around, and where they get localized and restricted to isn't necessarily where they originated. And so that it's great to protect genetic variation as well as species. That's fantastic. Unfortunately, we don't know enough about where it is. But ultimately, we're going to have to protect things where we can rather than where we might, in some theoretical sense, ideally think it would be the best place to do it.
Well, in Santa Fe, Mark Nelson, you've been sitting there listening to the radio for quite a while. And I really appreciate your forbearance.
I did want to interject on this topic, which I think probably people are aware of. But, you know, this issue, and you brought up the Andean potatoes, but, you know, one of the consequences of the spread of a certain type of conventional or industrial agriculture has been the elimination of this fantastic repository of variants of rice or wheat or virtually any crop that you're talking about. And the unintended consequence of the Green Revolution was to, you know, consolidate where India only has a handful of rice varieties that produce the vast majority of its production. So, you know, issues like that are being paid attention to. There's enormous effort by all kinds of both local and international bodies to try to preserve that diversity. And I think Chris was, you know, agreeing. I think it's kind of a no-brainer that biodiversity is critical. Absolutely, because we don't know what the future is. And, you know, so going back to, you know, my personal experience, I kind of loved. One is, but you know, Biosphere 2, like the NASA people or space people were saying, you know, we don't understand why you've got an ocean and a desert and a rainforest in something that's life support. And we were saying, well, you know, one of the really troubling things about our understanding of how our global biosphere operates is we don't know really how much of our life support, you know, is being supplied by these quote-unquote natural ecosystems, natural biomes. So one, as a laboratory for studying biospheres, we wanted to have both the farm, the human habitat, all the technology needed, but a variety of ecosystems so that we could see their, you know, their provision of critical vectors, not to speak of the psychological thing. You know, we as humans, you know, we have the biophilic tendency. We bond with life, and, you know, what kind of a world do we want to live with?
Yeah. Mark, thank you. Mark Nelson, biospherian and author of Pushing Our Limits, about his experience in Biosphere 2. Are we going to get more data out of this? You planned this thing originally. The Institute planned this experiment for 100 years, and then it got repurposed after a few years. And One of the things that you said that stuck with me in this book, many things stick with me, but this one in particular, this was not, we weren't designing a space habitat. We're way short of being able to do that. You know,
absolutely.
This is the early iteration. By the time we got onto Mars, we'd have to look at it in an entirely different way.
Yeah, although I'm a big proponent of space, and I, the ecological community, I think, has had an uneasy relationship with space. But when you think about, you know, what space sensors are teaching us about planet Earth, and you know, when we were conceiving of Biosphere 2 back in the early 1980s, comparative planetology was rearing its head. It seemed like a far out concept, but how much we learn about planet Earth by studying other planets in our solar system. Now, of course, the big gold rush is on, that we find that, you know, planets around stars are a very commonplace issue. So, you know, I think the Biosphere 2's 100-year experiment myself is still going on. It's still teaching us. It taught me what would happen, because we designed a pretty radical, you know, challenge to business as usual, including that our farm went totally beyond organic standards. We couldn't use some chemicals, okay, natural chemicals that are used in organic farming, because we had such a tightly sealed system and we wanted it to function for decades. So we're still, you know, so when I watched what especially Columbia University, a nice Ivy League school, what they did with turning a biospheric system into a greenhouse, you know, was pretty interesting. It kind of underscored to me how radical it all was.
Yeah. Yeah, well, no question about it. And it required an enormous input of energy to keep this thing going. For one thing, just to keep your pressure thing, you had these giant lung things interconnected. A lot of engineering. To cycle your water around, you had to use all kinds of pumps and stuff. And one thing I found really, really curious was that you used the microbes in your soil to detox your atmosphere.
Yeah, that was one of the technology I absolutely adored about Biosphere 2. It had been around quite a bit. And fortunately, there were some German professors at the University of Arizona who are familiar with it, soil biofiltration, using the microbial diversity in soils, and now they enrich soils or use compost to clean up foul-smelling or potentially dangerous trace gases in, you know, out of factories. So what people don't appreciate, we not only had a non-chemical, totally recycling agricultural system that set world records, but if we needed to, there was a lot of passive infiltration and cleanup of the atmosphere, but it was actually designed and engineered so we could push all of Biosphere 2's atmosphere up through our rich agricultural soils to lower any trace gases that were getting to be a problem.
And it's measurable. You did that.
Yeah, we did a lot of research in a test module and at the University of Arizona demonstrating this efficacy. Yeah, I mean, I loved that, and then I wound up doing 20 years of constructed wetlands, and I love this field. That, you know, part of the involvement that humans have to play with this changing, ever-changing, but now, you know, definitely our technosphere, our, you know, what's making the Anthropocene a reality, is that the magnitude of human impact on the planet is just undeniable. So one is, psychologically, we've got to get over, when psychologists test people, most people, like three-quarters of humans, still think that the environment is somehow outside of themselves. They don't understand that they're metabolically connected to the biosphere. We're part of it. So what I liked about Biosphere 2 is that we had to be actively involved. We talked about managing our atmosphere. We also, you know, kind of half-jokingly, and Tony Burgess, who you mentioned, I think, came up with the idea, because we have simplified food chains and we don't have the normal keystone predators, the biospherians, the human crew, will have to be the keystone predators. And I call it in the book and team biodiversity. We're going to intervene in the rainforest if, you know, some vines threaten a loss of crucial biodiversity. So that was one of our, you know, we weren't just standing by watching this ecological experiment unfold. We were part of it, and we were motivated because we loved our little world. And I think, you know, part psychologically, humans have got to accept, and it's not a difficult thing, it's actually quite a joyous thing. We are part of, we are an evolutionary product of, and we're integral to this biosphere that supports us. And we will have to take roles to defend it.
Well, I'm so glad you brought up love, Mark, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Not wanting to accept that we are part of the natural systems of our planet is the exact same thing that Chris Thomas talks about in his book, Inheritors of the Earth, how nature is thriving in an age of extinction. Chris, I happen to know for a fact that you have been out in the field measuring butterflies for many, many years, and you talk about some kind of tedious research. I mean, you basically have to trap the butterflies and tag them, and you then figure out where they put their eggs, and there's got to be love involved in that.
There certainly is, yes. Either that or I'm completely mad, yeah.
Both.
But you're driven by two things, aren't you? You're driven partly by the sort of enthusiasm for finding out the answer to something, which in the case of studying some of these butterflies was how they were evolving to cope with human changes, to cause changes to their habitat, including in a North American butterfly that was adjusting to the arrival of a European weed, and the caterpillars were starting to eat it. But so you're partly by the enthusiasm of the questions that you can answer, and partly out of, well, it's just, well, I'm not sure I would go so far as the love word, you know, but I am a reserved Brit after all. but you're just really so in the moment, watching the things, if you like, being at one with them, and it's a huge source of pleasure of just loving nature, whatever it's doing, however it someone or other thinks it's supposed to be, just nature doing what nature does is pretty interesting and amazing.
Do you believe in biophilia?
I also believe in biophobia.
Oh.
So I'd go for both simultaneously, because what I think is that there's not a it makes complete sense to me that as humans, I'm an evolutionary biologist, humans evolved as far as I'm concerned, we've come into existence, and the other animals and plants that are all around us have always, through the history of human evolution, have been incredibly important. Now, that has been the argument that E.O. Wilson and others have used to say, okay, there's going to be biophilia. You're going to be naturally interested in this stuff because it's important to you. It's your food. It matters to you. You're going to make your houses out of it and everything. So that's great, but it's also going to bite you. It's going to sting you. It's going to give you diseases. And if you go for a hike in the woods and there's a great big crack just behind you, you jump. And that is a pretty natural response of it. This could be something dangerous. And, you know, fear of snakes or whatever that a lot of people have, there's actually a good rationale for that. So I would say enthusiasm and interest for nature, yes, I go with that. But some of it's philia,
some of it's phobia, and some of the phobia makes absolutely no sense, like fear of a plant because it's foreign rather than because it's actually going to sting you.
Well, are you? Has the debate started yet with people like E.O. Wilson?
Yes, he's not particularly. He's called me and Earl Ellis and one or two others. He's referred to us as Anthropocene apologists.
Yes.
That's interesting. I would say that it's not taking a long enough time, sort of vision of time and space. But what I would really say is that even if you think there's another way the world should be without humans, it's too late. There's billions of us. We've already transformed. There isn't this, you know, as Mark was saying so eloquently, there isn't a nature and us that's separate. We're all part of the same thing. The entire biological systems, the planet, the climate change, the carbon dioxide that every plant on the planet consumes and then uses in its photosynthesis. These are it's a reality. We can't unpick now. It's too late. We can't unpick the human and non-human parts of the biological world. It is one thing. And that's why I think we just have to get on with it. And it doesn't mean we stop loving things. It doesn't mean we stop trying to save things. But it does mean that we accept the dynamics of nature and go with it, and that we recognize it's just as limited as legitimate to promote biological diversity gains in the future as it is to try and stop the losses of things that we've already got.
Do you, I understand you're quite the advocate for using zoological gardens and botanical gardens to maintain species and even provide them for out of breeding and transplanting. You know, I'm thinking we're actually really good at a lot of endangered species rescue when we put our minds to it.
But yes, we are. Of course, we tend to concentrate on big and well-known things, and most of biological diversity is small and wriggles.
Yeah, and that's what E.O. Wilson's worried about.
Well, I think it's really critical that habitat conservation happens, you know, exactly for that point that, you know, we need to make, you know, a wider brush than just trying to save the panda bears or individual species. But I wanted to make this point that, you know, we are part of the matrix, and it's our job to reinvent how we do business, how we farm, how we ranch, how we do our technology. The Russians, you know, who greatly influenced the whole thinking about the biosphere from Vernadsky on, they said, you know, the two major factors are the biosphere and the technosphere, and they are currently at war with each other. The technosphere was kind of developed before people had any idea that smokestacks here and there. And
hey, guess what? We're out of time.
Oh, no.
Maybe you guys can come back next week. I got another show next week.
Yeah.
I want to keep this theme
and
going.
Let the technosphere help the biosphere. That's right. What we need to do.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
I was thinking we could do it.
Thank you. A great pleasure to be with you.
All right. Chris Thomas and Mark Nelson, and thank you to Wesley Early and Alistair Keeley at York, Eric Bork in the technical department, and Dave Waldron. I am Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
This program is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This is Alaska Public Media.